Yeah. Well, I'm very pleased to and proud to be invited to give these lectures. There's actually two numerical analysis lectures going on because Randy Levesque is going to be the next Coxeter speaker, and he's one of our graduates from Stanford, so I'm always pleased to see that. At any rate, I've never done a bit of work in geometry, but nevertheless, I'm very pleased to speak at these in this series. So the title of my talk is Matrices, Moments, and Quadrature. It's a title I've used very often, and what I do is well, there's two ways of going, you know, with mathematicians. Either they, change the title but give the same talk, or I tend to keep the same talk and title and then change the contents. At least I hope I am. So that's what I'll be doing. So this is a topic I've been interested in for, I suppose, close to 30 years, and it, or over 30 years, and it came about because I missed a lecture. There's a series of lectures given at the University of Maryland, and I came a day late, but everybody told me that I had missed a wonderful lecture by Hans Weinberger, so I later got a copy of that talk, and that sort of inspired me to work on this topic. It's not quite exactly the same as what he originally talked about, but it's very similar. And so I've continued to work on it. And of course, the other thing is, once you have this little tool, then you discover that there are all kinds of problems you can apply this tool to. And I'm going to discuss that at some length here. And there are many applications of these ideas to a variety of problems. Now, the other day, I happened to stick my head into this room, and I saw that one of the lecturers was using the blackboard. I thought, this is a wonderful blackboard, and you know, among other great properties of this building, is having these 9 blackboards, and it's a rare treat. I'm in a new building at Stanford. It's called the Gates Building, and we have blackboards, but they're about the third of the size of each one of those panels, so they're not very it's not very good for mathematicians. So matrices, moments, and quadrature, and what I love to do is connect the three topics together and show how they can be used. So let me begin first by something closely connected with the original talk given by Weinberger, and it goes like the following. So here we have a system of linear equations, AX equals B, and A is going to be a symmetric matrix, and it's positive definite. And then the idea is that we have some kind of approximation to the solution. So here's the true solution, X is what we're trying to obtain. C is our approximation, E is the error. So C approximation, and E is the error. And what we're seeking to do is say something about the error vector. And of course, to make a statement about the error vector, we have to do some side calculation. So let's compute the residual vector. Now, in this discussion that I'll give in the next couple lectures, I won't discuss round-off error at any length. So whenever I say we'll compute the residual vector, I mean we assume that we know it precisely. So the residual vector is just B minus AXC. So that's an easy enough calculation. But B is just AX minus AXC. And so that's just AE. Okay. All right, so we have those quantities. And that tells us, of course, and throughout this talk I'll use norms, but I'll most often use the two norm. So the residual vector R divided by the norm of A is a lower bound on the error vector, and B the norm, we multiply it through by A inverse times the norm of R. And what does that tell us then? It says that if we compute a residual, and if that residual vector is large relative to A, then the error has to be big. So a large residual normalized always implies that we have a big error. On the other hand, this is a much weaker inequality, so to speak. Even if the residual is small, then if you multiply by the norm of the inverse, and the norm of the inverse is large, we still may be far away from the solution. So we would like to sort of improve upon these bounds by using additional information. And the question is, what sort of information can we get? Okay. So what we'll do is we'll calculate some additional information. So let me call R0 equal to R, and then R1 is A times R0, R2 is A times R1, and so forth down to RK. So here we have these K plus 1 vectors, and of course this is just A to the kth power times R0, and as already pointed out in the previous lecture, one doesn't want to compute this sequence in general, but let's, for theoretical basis, let's assume that we've made that calculation. And now, if we look at the inner product of Ri and Rj, that's just equal to the inner product of A to the I power times R0, A to the J power times R0, and because A is symmetric, we can write that as A to the I plus J power R0 times R0. So this just depends upon the sum of the indices. And let me write this down then as I plus J goes from 0, 1, up to 2K, because I have these K plus 1 vectors, R0 through RK. Okay. So that's good news and bad news. And I'll give this a definition. I'll write this as mu sub I plus J. Well, the notation mu should be of some indication here, and it's going to be connected with moments. So suppose we have a set of eigenvectors. This is a symmetric matrix again. Okay, we'll normalize these vectors so that they all have length 1. And now let's write the initial vector, R0, as in terms of the eigenvectors, alpha I times ui. Okay. And in the future now, we'll order the eigenvalues, lambda 1 up to lambda n. And throughout this, I use little b for an upper bound on the largest eigenvalue, little a for a lower bound on the smallest eigenvalue, and that's a number we assume will be 0. And these will play an important role, A and B. And therefore, I have to separate my So therefore we have the vector Rj . You can see this lecture is going to be a lot of work for me. Maybe that's good. Rj is the sum alpha I to the jth power times the vector, so that our inner product is just equal to, I'll give it one subscript, mu sub s is the sum alpha I squared lambda I to the s power. Okay. So these are really moments of a certain distribution that we have. So these quantities, mu sub s, which are the inner products of these various vectors I have written up over there, these mu sub s are quantities we can calculate, and here's a representation. And let me write this as an integral of lambda to the s power d alpha of lambda. And this, of course, is over the interval a, b. All right? So we have this s equals 0, 1 up to 2k. So we have these 2k moments. And our error, the norm of e squared in the 2 norm, well, you can see that the error is just a inverse times r. Well, that's just equal to the integral of lambda to the minus second power ds, and that's equal to mu minus 2. Okay, so here's what the problem is, our new stated problem. The problem. Yeah?
Not the S, the alpha lambda.
The alpha lambda, thanks.
It might be nice to show everyone the alpha.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you. This is a lovely blackboard, and even the chalk is nice here, so I really enjoyed this. Okay. So, here's our problem. We're given these moments, mu sub I equals 0 to 2k, give upper and lower bounds on mu minus 2. Okay? So now, as always in mathematics, when you say give these upper and lower bounds, it depends what information that you have. So let's see, look at various possibilities. So one possibility is the following. Suppose for some reason you have the eigenvalues, I. And exactly, you know those exactly, and you know the mu s is the sum of alpha I squared lambda I to the s power. Okay, and we have these 2k plus 1 quantities. And then we want to maximize the sum, alpha I squared, mu, lambda I to the minus second power. So this is a classical linear programming problem. We have a set of equalities. We have 2k plus 1 equalities. These alphas, we're assuming that they're the unknown quantities. So we want to maximize or minimize these quantities. That will give us either upper bound or a lower bound. Okay, and so to solve a problem like that, it's a linear programming, and there are many ways of solving this, but a classical way of solving it is the simplex method devised by George Danzig. And what's nice is there are all kinds of van der Moons floating around and so forth. Although I've stressed, by the way, that all these matrices are finite dimensional, you could actually extend this and it would not be impossible to solve this kind of mathematical programming problem. So that's one method that's used. Of course, that makes a big assumption. Now, another possibility is the following. What we find a polynomial, let's say P2k of lambda, which let's say I'll write that as C0 plus C1 lambda plus C2k lambda to the 2k power, and let's say lambda is between A and B. Okay? So here's some polynomial. And then our problem is, find this polynomial P2k of lambda, which dominates lambda to the minus second for lambda in this interval. That's all. That's what I really wanted to say. Okay? So somehow you want to find a polynomial which dominates lambda to the minus second power throughout the interval. Okay. Now, there are many polynomials. After all, if you have a polynomial which satisfies that, if you add C naught, add a constant to C naught, you still get the same solution. You'll get a... So what we want to do, well, then if you integrate P2k of lambda d alpha of lambda, that's just equal to C naught mu naught plus C1 mu1 plus and so forth plus C2k mu 2k. All right. So that's why this would yield an upper bound for lambda to the minus second power. So we want to minimize C naught mu naught plus C2k mu 2k over all CIs. So this kind of problem arises in other connections, and it's called semi-infinite programming. So there's a whole area of research called semi... After all, in linear programming, you have a finite set of inequalities. In semi-infinite programming, it's you have a parameter there, and you want to solve that problem. Okay, and then our third problem, our technique, finally, is to go back to our original statement about lambda, this quantity here. This is really an integral, and what we want to do, and we'll is to write this as a quadrature formula. Okay, and that's the method that we're going to describe. It's can be used in many different situations, and I'll describe in a minute my general problem. Now, I've talked about finding the solution vector, but there are other things you might want to look at, and we don't always emphasize this in computations. So, for instance, here we know x equals A inverse B. Okay. Now, the way we state things in numerical analysis, it's as if you want the entire vector. But often you don't want the entire vector. Instead, you might want one component of the solution vector. In other words, what you really want to estimate is E1 transpose times X, which you can see is just E1 transpose A inverse B. So in other words, this will give us one component of the solution vector. This is not a quadratic form. This is a bilinear form, and the question is how to estimate such quantities. And there, in a similar vein, if you, for instance, wanted to estimate one component of the error vector or some linear combination of the solution vector, you would get into a general situation where you want to compute C transpose A inverse B. And now what would you do? This is no longer a quadratic form. It's a bilinear form. What would you do? Well, there's a familiar trick. You can write P as C plus B and Q as C minus B. And so C transpose A inverse B is just equal to 1 quarter P transpose A inverse P minus Q transpose A inverse Q. Okay. So we can write this as the difference of two quadratic forms. If we can get a max on this and a min on that, then we'll have an upper bound. And so our whole discussion will be on estimating quadratic forms. Okay, so this is our the discussion. We're given a matrix. A and some arbitrary vector u and some analytic function f. And the problem is, well, it's sort of like twofold. Give upper and lower bounds for u transpose f of a u. Okay, so that that falls our previously discussed problem, or in a similar way, estimate u transpose f of a u. They're not quite the same. They're of course very closely related, but sometimes we'll want upper and lower bounds. Sometimes we'll want to estimate these quantities. Okay, and we'll concentrate on just problems of that nature. And what we'll discover, I'll try to give lots of examples, we'll discover that there are many situations where one wants to solve problems of this nature. So I have transparencies for what I'm about to say, but I think I'd like to write it out, and I don't know if it's better or worse. If I do transparencies, then you get over all this stuff much more quickly. On the other hand, you might understand it more if I write it out on the blackboard. So let me write it out, but if anybody feels I'm going too slowly, and I see too many people winking off, then maybe I'll just go straight over to transparencies. Okay, so let me mention a few problems. Let's see, do I have any clean blackboards at this time? Nope. Okay. So, here's a problem that comes up very often in studying all kinds of applied mathematics problems. Minimize u transpose a u minus 2b transpose u. All right, so that's a classical problem. We know what the solution to that, but we have a constraint. And that the constraint is that the length of the solution vector be equal to alpha. So we have a quadratic constraint. And this comes up very often in lots of different contexts. Actually, it's connected with the least squares problem, but I'm going to just talk about the this classical case. Yes, so what should I change? No, I'm bound to make mistakes because I've changed the notation from my notes here, so, but we'll go ahead with this. Okay, so we introduce Lagrange multipliers, as we often do. We have u transpose a u minus 2b transpose x plus, I'm bound to screw up here now, u transpose, at least you see, you have to pay some attention to the lecture, find the errors as I go along. All right. So here's mu, it's a Lagrange multiplier. Sometimes this is assigned the value mu, but very often, because we have this constraint, we really want to solve for mu. And so what we do, when we differentiate, we get a system of equations of the following sort, equals b. And the equation we would get out of this is that u is equal to a plus ui inverse times b. And since the length of u is equal to alpha, then we would have B transpose A plus mu I to the minus second power times B is equal to alpha squared. All right. So this equation, which I sometimes call the secular equation, or especially after it's diagonalized, that equation is it's very hard to solve for this parameter mu. And we'll talk about how one can approximate the solution. Okay, so this really falls into the category that I've been discussing. That is, here I have some quadratic form. I know A. I'm trying to find mu, all right? And I want to solve this equation. There are actually as many as two n roots for this particular problem. And in most of the problems that we're interested in, this parameter alpha is smaller than what you would have gotten if you had no constraint. So alpha is less than, let me put it, A inverse B. Okay. So that means that mu will turn out to be positive. This kind of problem arises in many applications. Statisticians use this often. They don't solve for the parameter mu, but they call this a ridge regression. So in ridge regression and statistics, they have this parameter mu. It's a positive parameter, and it's used to get solve for damped least squares problems. So this is now fitting into our framework. We have f of a, our function, is a plus mu I to the minus second power. And so I'll diagonalize a in terms of its eigenvectors and eigenvalues. And let me write beta as being equal to q transpose b. So that this equation here just looks like, well, beta transpose lambda plus mu I to the minus second power beta equals alpha squared. Okay, so we have a, you know, if you ever revise this building, the one thing I would suggest is another screen over here. I would have liked to, I have a transparency here. Well, I'll just write it this way. So I'll write f of a and mu as being equal to the sum beta I squared over lambda I plus mu squared. So the poles are all at, for mu equals minus lambda I. And the situation is of the following nature. Oh, maybe I can. Oh, that's an idea. Let me... Oh, let me put it over here. Sorry to... And there's a plug over there. So occasionally maybe I'll... Thanks a lot. And if we get this up high enough... Okay. And oh, sorry. Oh. Which wall? Oh. Yeah, that's even. My God. Good. Oh, I'm really in, so can you see it back there, or Jacob, can you? No, no, not at all. We'll wait till the audience shifts right. All right. So you can. So here's the function f of a and mu, and we're looking. Here's alpha square. Here's mu star. This is what we're looking for. Here's zero, because as I said, mu star is going to be positive. And how can we determine mu star without computing the eigenvalues? Okay. And eigenvectors of the matrix A. So, you see, I'm going to easily fall into being lazy here. Let me. Good. Okay, well, here are some other problems that I've discussed, but there are a whole bunch of things. Suppose we want to just determine the diagonal elements of the inverse of a matrix. Then the vector U is just EJ. I'll talk about regularization as we go on. That's another topic that I'd like to cover. Okay, so let me just mention what I've said already. We diagonalize the matrix A, and then we have a Stieltjes integral. And here I have a representation of the weight function for the Stieltjes integral. And our key problem then is to estimate upper and lower bounds on our integral. And that's what I'll spend time on now. So years ago, I tell this repeatedly, so I hope you'll bear with me. Years ago, the International Congress of Mathematicians met in Berkeley. And James Gleick, who's a well-known writer, covered the meeting. He wrote a book called Chaos, many of you may know. And he was talking about presentations. And he said, well, everybody was instructed to give an elementary part to their lectures, all the invited speakers. So that was the first part of their lectures. Everybody was supposed to understand what they're doing in the mathematical context. Then the second part of the lecture, well, was really addressed to the five or six experts in the world who could understand the lecture, understand the speaker. And finally, the third part of the lecture, nobody would understand, because how else would the mathematical community take the person seriously if anybody understands you? So then he said, well, in the interest of expediency, some people immediately went to part three of their lecture. And I hope I don't get there too soon, so I'll try to make things clear so that all of you can understand parts of my lecture. Okay, so we're going to talk. So is it all, are people satisfied? I'll take a vote. No, is it all right to write on the blackboard? Is that, that's, all right. That's being old-fashioned and
it's so enjoyable to sit in a lecture again.
Oh, well, thank you. So far I've covered matrices, moments. Now I have to talk about the quadrature part of the lecture. And it all goes back to our friend Gauss. And I'm going to talk about Gauss Radow rules. Okay. And there's also Lobato. Now, does anybody know who Radow was? Chandler, you're old enough to know a lot of history. So here is the idea in Gauss quadrature rules. We're given a set of moments. Mu sub r is the integral. Lambda of the r, well, pardon me for changing notation as I go along, dw of lambda. And r goes 0, 1, 2k, and we'll see exactly why, plus m minus 1. Okay? So I've added in some additional moments here. And then the idea is to find a quadrature rule, which I'll talk about, so that when you integrate f of lambda, dw of lambda, that's I of f, that's our numerical integral, plus r of f. All right? And I of f, then, is going to be equal to the sum ai f of ti, I equals 1 to k, plus the sum bj f at zj, j equals 1 to m. All right. Now, in this quadrature rule, the ai's and the ti's, they're unknown. And the ZJs are prescribed. That's what makes it Radow. So Radow had the idea of prescribing some of the nodal points. So that's why we've introduced ZJs. So the BJs, they're going to have to be calculated. Okay. So this is what Gauss quadrature rule consists of. Weighting the function at several of these values, and then incorporating also these known values of the function. Now, we could try to solve these equations. I'll write I of lambda to the r, that's our rth moment, that's supposed to be equal to the sum ai ti to the rth power, I equals 1 to k, plus the sum bj f of zj, j equals 1 to m. And remember, this is it's for r equals 0, 1, up to 2k plus m minus 1. So look at here. This is really a system of nonlinear equations. We have 2k plus m mu's. Here we have k ai's, k ti's. So these are the weights. These are the nodes. And then we have these mbj's. So we have the right number of equations and the right number of unknowns. And you could attempt to solve these equations, but we're not going to do it that way. Oops, this should have been. Chandler, you have to keep me on the ball here. Okay. We could attempt to solve these equations. And later on, I'll talk about how we actually can compute the AIs and TIs and the BJs without solving these non-linear equations explicitly. But you could think of using Newton's method or something of that. So another thing you can think about, although it's not, and in some special cases you might want to do that, these mu's are really the solution to a difference equation. And therefore you could say, well, why not compute the difference equation for which the TIs are the characteristic equation? And you can actually sit down a system of equations, then solve those for those difference equations. All right. Now, here's the amazing thing. For a moment, I'll forget about this term here. What turns out are these AIs They're all positive. They're all real and positive. And the TIs are all belong to the interval AB. Okay, so that's the amazing fact that you can always find, forget about this part for just a moment, that gets introduces some slight complications, and we won't be concerned about that. But this is the amazing thing about Gauss quadrature rules. You can find the AIs and the TIs, and we'll describe some very nice algorithms for doing that computation. At any rate, if we solve these equations, there is a remainder term. So R of F looks like the following. F of 2k plus mth derivative at some point c on the interval over 2k plus m factorial, the integral ab, the product of lambda minus zj, j equals 1 to m, the product of lambda minus ti, I equals 1 to k, all this is squared, dw of lambda. So this is the key, so to speak. This number c, of course, is between a and b. And this is going to be the key to our whole problem. Okay? So this is non-negative. And so this is the beautiful thing, by the way, about Gauss quadrature. Again, let me consider m equals 0. What does it say? If you can compute the Gauss quadrature rule here, that says you can evaluate the function at k points, but it's the error is proponential to the 2kth derivative. In other words, if you compute the Gauss quadrature rule, you can integrate a polynomial of degree 2k minus 1 or less, and it would be exact, this integral, even though you're evaluating it only at k points. Okay, so that's... All right, so now here's our key point. If m equals 1, that's truly the Gauss-Radel rule, and the 2k plus first derivative at c is negative, okay, and z1 equals a, what do we have? So this guy is negative. We're going to use this quadrature rule that we're going to generate somehow. This guy is negative. This is lambda minus a, so this is positive, this is positive. This whole remainder term is negative, so the remainder term, r of f, is less than or equal to 0. And that implies, if we compute the integral, I of f, that must be equal to an upper bound. Upper bound. Okay. And likewise, if the 2k plus first derivative, xc, is less than or equal to 0, and now we're going to take z1 equals b, then the remainder term throughout the interval is greater than or equal to 0, and that says that I of f is the lower bound. Okay. So that's exactly gives us the key to the solving our problem, the problem that I originally posed. So, let's... Let me just summarize what I would do in the first problem. So here's mu minus 2. That's r transpose a to the minus second power r. Okay, and suppose we compute all these quantities. Mu sub L is equal to R transpose A to the L R. We've seen how to do that using a Krylov sequence. And then rho I'll call equals Q transpose times R. That's the eigenvector. So that this these are just equal to the sum lambda I to the lth power times rho I squared. So that falls within our model. Okay? So our problem then is to determine a quadrature rule. If we could determine our quadrature rule, in other words, using these moments, if we determine our quadrature rule with either little a or little b as one of the z's, then we can determine an upper and lower bound. So let me just say a few more things about Gauss quadrature. And remember, we have to solve this nonlinear equation. Now, the key to this is really interesting. Now, is Canada such a good country, good mathematical training, where people learn about orthogonal polynomials? Do you know if students learn about orthogonal? Are there any students here? Huh? But it's really amazing how it's not very often in the curriculum, orthogonal polynomials, and yet it's a wonderful tool that we can have. All right, so the answer is of Gauss quadrature comes in terms of orthogonal polynomials. So suppose we determine a set of polynomials, PR lambda, PS of lambda, d alpha of lambda, equal to 0 for R not equal to S. And I have an alpha, so I'm sorry if I switch back and forth, but I may do that. And as is well known, there's a key relationship about orthogonal polynomials. PJ plus 1 of lambda is equal to lambda minus CJ plus 1 times PJ of lambda minus beta J squared. Eta J squared times PJ minus 1 of lambda. Okay, so this is a three-term recurrence relationship. So all orthogonal polynomials satisfy this three-term relationship. Let me write a tridiagonal matrix J sub K. So J sub K is made up of these Xs and Etas. So we have Xi1 up to Xik here, Eta 1 up to Eta K minus 1. Okay. So J sub K is a symmetric tridiagonal matrix. And it has a complete set of eigenvalues and eigenvectors. So, for instance, JK, VJ equals lambda J. I'll call it TJ, excuse me. TJ times VJ. Okay. And we're assuming that the vectors have been normalized to have length 1. VJ equals 1. Okay, so these eigenvectors all have length 1. And by the way, so underlying here, the zeroth moment is equal to 1. That's just a normalization. So here's the remarkable thing is these TJs, these are equal to the Gauss nodes. Okay. And the AJ is just V1J squared. It's the square of the first component of each one of those eigenvectors. So that's really a very useful algorithm for computing Gauss quadrature. So in the old days, people had very thick books where they would have different weight functions connected with Jacobi polynomials, And then you'd have to look up to 12 or 15 significant places, the quadrature rule. And now it's very easy to calculate in a flash. One generates this tridiagonal matrix, computes its eigenvalues, and the first component of each eigenvector. Now, how do you compute a first component of an eigenvector, and how do you compute eigenvalues of tridiagonal matrices? Well, there are people who are still working on computing. It's a almost a hot topic, especially in connection with parallel computation. But there is a method called the QR method. The QR method. And the QR method has the property that you can very accurately compute all the eigenvalues of a matrix, and you can arrange the software or the program in such a way that you just compute the first component of each eigenvector. So computing, doing Gauss quadrature, is a very easy matter. Let's see, where's my friend Chandler? Are you the oldest one here, Chandler? I don't. Who would you attribute this three-term recurrence relationship to?
Well, I don't know. Nicole, going in this direction.
Well, I always say it's Steel Cheese who did it. Yeah, so it'd be interesting. I'm almost certain it was Steel Cheese, but I'm not completely sure. Okay. Now, what do we do when what about Gauss-Radow? So Gauss-Radow, remember, specified one of the nodes of the quadrature rule. So the Gauss-Radow rule means that little a or little b is one of the eigenvalues of the matrix. Well, I'll call that number t-naught. So t-naught is one of the eigenvalues. So we want this to be actually a zero of the k plus first polynomial. That gives us a relationship between this element here, ck plus 1, t naught, and a to k squared, which is known. And it turns out, miraculously, that you can just have to solve this tridiagonal system of equations with t naught, and then update t naught to get ck plus 1, and that gives you the Gauss-Radow rule. So calculating the Gauss-Radow rule is connected with an inverse eigenvalue problem. So an inverse eigenvalue problem means that you're given the eigenvalues and then compute the matrix. This is a very simple one. You compute the bottom element of this matrix, JK plus 1 bar, so that the matrix has a prescribed eigenvalue. Okay. All right, so now, here's the nice thing here. If we can connect it with our problem, if we compute the eigenvalues of the tridiagonal matrix, well, we want to evaluate, those are the TIs, and I put a zero here because we have a T naught. So JK plus 1 bar has this decomposition here. And notice V transpose E1 is the first component of V. And here's a nice thing. The integral then is just, look, V transpose times E1 is the first component of the eigenvector, which is the square root of the weight. Here's the other side of the weight. This is a diagonal matrix. So when we're all done, the integral, the exact integral that you, from the Gauss-Radow rule, is equal to F evaluated at JK plus 1 bar. That's our tridiagonal matrix. And then we simply have to compute this quadratic form. All right, so that says for our, to get the minus second moment, we compute, this would be JK plus 1 bar inverse. So you would have, this would be equal to, that's equal to E1 transpose JK plus 1 bar to the minus 2 E1. Okay. So, we've gone through various stages, and we'll go through more as we go on. Estimating an upper and lower bound on this quadratic form consists of computing a whole bunch of moments, all right, computing those moments, computing the quadrature rule, or computing the tridiagonal matrix. So we want to go from moments to the tridiagonal matrix. Then once we compute the tridiagonal matrix, well, what do we end up with? Another quadratic form. It's just a smaller quadratic form. And depending on whether T naught is equal to little a or T naught is equal to little b, we get either a lower bound or an upper bound on the minus 2 moment, and that gives us an upper or lower bound. We can vary k here. We get a sequence of bounds, which you can show are continually improving. Well, a key point now, which we'll discuss next time, is how to get this tridiagonal matrix. And we don't have to, there's a very slick algorithm for doing it, and we'll discuss that. And we'll discuss many applications. Now, this, as I told you, once you have this tool, there are many different applications, and I'll just mention a couple of them. One is generalized cross-validation. That's a technique that's used in statistics for estimating the parameter for regularizing solutions. So I'll talk about that. Plus, there's some work done on computing or estimating the determinant of a matrix. So for quantum chromodynamics, people are required to compute the determinant or estimate the determinant for large-scale matrices. Also, the trace of the inverse of a matrix. Those computations, they may, you know, mathematically, of course, they're trivial, but from a numerical point of view, they're extremely difficult, especially for large-scale problems. And some of the algorithms I'll discuss will enable one to get a good estimate of those quantities. And I think you have your seminar to go to. Okay. So thank you, and then we'll meet again tomorrow. I'll go further into this topic.